Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the Three Bid League podcast, coming to you mid-week after an exciting day of games. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. We will be joined momentarily by the head coach of GW, Chris Caputo, to talk about the great start to A-10 play for the Colonials and just various other things about the players on the roster, how this team all came together to really improve this year. And then afterwards, we're going to talk about a crazy, crazy Wednesday. Six super interesting games. And yes, if you're willing to wait it out till the end, we will talk about the Uber Eats driver hoax at Duquesne. Just a reminder for anyone interested, we did talk about last week's games earlier in this week, so be sure to go back and listen to that. And without further ado, here is Coach Chris Caputo. All right, we are now joined by a very special guest, the head coach of the red hot 5-2 George Washington Colonials, Chris Caputo. Thank you for joining us, Coach.
Thanks, Tyler. Appreciate it. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, so it's a fun time to be talking about GW basketball. As we're recording this, less than 24 hours removed from an incredibly fun, at least from a watching perspective, maybe not for you from a stress perspective, overtime win over St. Joe's. You guys swung an upset over Dayton last weekend, although wouldn't be an upset now as you guys are now above the Flyers in the standings. But what has it been like in the locker room this week for these guys, especially coming back and beating Dayton, which was a team that beat these guys pretty handedly twice last season?
Well, I think our group has been pretty even keeled, our response to winning and losing has been good. And, you're trying to find some consistency in how you prepare and also how you play. And I think if you can be consistent in your response in terms of, hey, how you handle yourself when you win, how you handle yourself when you lose, then you have a chance to find some consistency in performance. And so I think we've been able to do that, for the most part throughout the year. So it's been pretty, obviously it's exciting to, play well and get a little bit of attention or what have you, but, it's very still very early in conference play. And I think guys have been pretty focused, which is good.
So most of those guys are returnees from last season under the previous coaching regime. And these days with the transfer portal, you got to sit down and have conversations with all these guys when you take over a program. Like, they can leave on the drop of a dime if they want to. So take us back to right after you got this job, whether it's these guys in general or someone specific, like a James Bishop or a Ricky Linda or an Amir Harris. What were those conversations like with these guys, trying to get them, convince them to stay while also setting the expectations for what you wanted them to be as players?
Well, I think it was a very strange time to get a job, in a sense that, it's the first year of immediate eligibility transfers plus visits. Because if you remember last year, while there was immediate eligibility, there were no visits because of COVID. You add the idea that NIL it was in place this spring, and then you had a very, very odd time. For me, we had, I believe, 11 scholarship players maybe plus a signee. And so maybe where I was a little bit different than some guys is, we did have a roster that was intact. Now, we very quickly lost two players, Joe Babasile and Breon Freeman. We were very active in recruiting. But the one thing that I would say, I didn't want to do was panic, because I think that can happen in the spring. I felt I've always been a big believer. It's you know, not the guy that you don't get that beats you. It's the guy that gets you that isn't good enough or is the wrong person. That those guys beat you every single day, you know? And so we were, I think, pretty methodical about that. And actually, I think there's some people that were not critical, but I think they were wondering like what we were doing. And I was like, what we were doing is making sure that we kept the right people in the program. And then, you know, if we were going to make an addition, you know, we're going to feel like it was people who would, you know, have a positive effect. And we swung and missed on some guys. But I was okay with that because I thought they were the right guys. And then, you know, we're able to get Max and EJ Clark. Obviously EJ was, he was great for us till he got hurt. And Max, you know, I don't know. I think like if the season was over today, he'd be the rookie of the year in the league, you know?
So one of those guys who really seems to be the right guy for this team is your leading scorer in James Bishop. And yeah. I had the great chance to talk to you back at Media Day, and a quote that's rung around in my head all season since that moment is that you wanted him to be more efficient, to have a better shot selection, whether that's what he's deciding to do on the court or you as his coach finding ways to get him better shots. Yeah. Well, his scoring's up, his assists are up, and his two-point percentage is up 10% this year. So he's putting up huge numbers without the extra volume. What was it like getting him ready for this season and really helping him out to be this excellent player that he's turned into?
Yeah, I mean, it was easy, to be honest. I mean, he really loves the game. He works his tail off. He knows the game. He's highly intelligent. I think anything that, you know, I was trying to articulate to him about, you know, kind of like what I wanted and what we were going to try to do schematically for him, you know, there was no pushback whatsoever. He totally was on board and understood, you know, what I was thinking. And obviously, you know, he has the ball quite a bit. And I think if you look at his efficiency numbers combined with his usage, I mean, it's just really incredible to have somebody with that high of a usage and yet the efficiency numbers where they are. He's been incredible in terms of a guy who, I don't know, some people told me, well, you know, he's not a point guard. And it's like, yeah, I don't know if he's a point guard or not, but man, he's a good decision maker, right? Every opportunity to make a good decision, you know, he's batting a pretty good percentage in terms of choices, you know?
Yeah, top five in the nation in scoring and number two in the A-10 in assists this year. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's around him every day, what's his confidence level like? Because watching him on TV, he seems like a guy where the opponent doesn't matter, the guy guarding him doesn't matter, the moment doesn't matter. He feels like he can make a play whenever he wants.
Yeah, he's steady. I mean, he's very even keel. I think very confident in his abilities. If he misses a couple of shots in a row, it doesn't bother him. He's just a very skillful basketball player. I think he knows he's a skillful basketball player. He's an excellent with the ball. I think, you know, for me, I've just been, you know, very blessed to have him because I think, you know, he's a guy that it's very probably hard to prepare for. You know, he can play on the ball and off the ball, and he's problematic for the defense, you know, no matter where he is.
Yeah, and I think overall with GW this year, Bishop has gotten a lot of the attention deservedly with his crazy scoring numbers. But what I've been, I think, most impressed with is how he makes his teammates better this year. Yeah. And specifically, I wanted to ask you about two of your post players, Ricky Lindo and Hunter Dean, who have been two of the more efficient guys in the conference, both around 70% from two-point range right now.
Yeah.
What have you tried to do to work through them as much as possible? Because overall, too, you've had one of the best two-point shooting teams in the country this season.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think their teammates have helped them tremendously. Those guys have been good finishing plays, continuing to try to work to find, you know, opportunities and put them in spots where they can be successful. I probably could continue to do a better job there as well. You know, they're not traditional post-up players per se, although I think they're very efficient around the basket. So you're trying to find, you know, where can you create opportunities for them to do what they've done best. But some of it is, you know, playing off James Bishop, Brendan Adams, Max Edwards. And those guys have been, you know, just really smart about their opportunities and converting them.
Yeah, and Matt touches on my favorite part of this team, which is the efficiency at the rim. You guys are top 10 nationally in two-point percentage, an amazing 57.3%. And it's due to a bunch of super talented offensive guys on your team. And I look at that three-headed backcourt with Bishop, Adams, and Edwards. And how do you manage putting together an offense with three guys who are so good at attacking one-on-one off the dribble, who can get their own shot all the time? How do you bring them together to make sure that they're moving the ball properly, getting it to Hunter Dean and Ricky Lindo and these other guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we think about how we design, you know, our way of playing offensively, you know, we wanted to, play with the pass. We want to play on 2 feet when we get in the paint, try to create cutting opportunities off that, play into a driving kick game off that, try to get good spacing. Our staff has done a tremendous job, you know, messaging that to the players and, you know, championing the, you know, the pass, like hitting the open man, you know, praising that. And yet, you know, you balance that with two guys and even a third, maybe in Max Edwards, that are very, very difficult individual matchups for players defensively. So, you know, I think it's a fine line. I think, you know, we've tried to get in action early, tried to put two on the ball, tried to create action with our front court players that would open them up some, but ultimately also knowing that, you know, the guys who are the very creative and talented scorers are going to have the ball in their hands more so. And, you know, those guys have, I think, found a good balance between, you know, I don't think anybody would watch us and say that, you know, those guys are pigs with the ball. And yet I think also people might say, yeah, man, they keep the ball in the hands of the guys who are the threats. But it's a fine line, really, you know, when you think about it.
And one of those biggest threats, Brendan Adams, he was a guy who fell out of the starting lineup at the end of last season. His minutes were going down as the year went on. Now he's headed straight for an all-conference spot. What's been the biggest thing for him this year in becoming such a good player after a rough end to last season?
I mean, I've felt like Brendan was my type of guy. You know, he's serious-minded. He's tough. He loves the game. He's a great teammate. He works his tail off. I feel like I didn't really spend too much time thinking about what his end of year last year or whatever was. I just felt like he's a guy who was about the right stuff, had the right makeup to be a successful player at the college level. And I'm really happy that he's seeing the fruits of his labor. You know, I think it's a good story. It's really a really good college basketball story that I don't think people, you know, maybe are talking enough about.
Yeah, and I think another great story from this year, just with GW in general, that I've noticed, and Tyler and I have been watching the A-10 long enough to remember where, you know, back in the mid to late 2000s, the Smith Center was as tough of a place as there is in the conference to play. This year, that started to come back, and I needed to ask you about what it's been like connecting with the fans and students. We know that you've been involved in a few pregame activities with the student sections. I think you were handing out coffee and donuts before the Dayton game last week. So what has that overall been like, just interacting with all of them this year?
Yeah, I think everyone that I've met that is connected to the GW community, alums, faculty, staff, I think they can almost to a person agree that the way to sort of unite and inspire the GW community is through certainly men's and women's basketball program and our program in particular, with the history of that, creating the environment, you know, at the Smith Center, which is really one of the neat and unique arenas, you know, in college basketball. It's we've got some cool ones in the Atlantic 10, but, you know, ours is, you know, nestled obviously right in the middle of Washington, D.C., you know, blocks from the Lincoln Memorial, you know, blocks from the Watergate, the White House. And yet there's this really cool 5,000 seat arena that I think our administration has done a tremendous job, you know, sort of modernizing and dressing up. And so, you know, unfortunately, COVID, you know, probably cost the environment some in terms of just no fans and things like that. And I thought, you know, the first step for me to bring people back into the building was to get the students engaged. And I found a very, very willing student population who really wanted to be a part of it. And it's, you know, our players' effort and play has sort of combined with our students' interest level and enthusiasm. And that's really, I think, our student section is as good as any, you know, from what I can see, especially on certain nights when, you know, I mean, you go back to the South Carolina game, we closed off the block, we had a block party and like 1,500 students that were, you know, just loud as can be. It can be a very loud and difficult environment to play in.
And a lot of coaches don't go out amongst the students in the way you have this year. I know at least on TV, they've shown two different little pregame things that they've put together where you've shown up and talked to them before you head into the arena. When you're interacting with these students, is it a lot of, oh, great job, coach, happy to have you? Or are any of these guys coming up to you and actually trying to talk to you about GW basketball, maybe with some opinions of their own of things you can do as the coach?
I'm sure they all have their own opinions. They might be a little bit, I'm getting to the age where they might be a little scared to, like, you know, bring that stuff up. But I would say, you know, like, again, I think in a weird way, like in a cool way, I think our students understand the role that they play in, you know, the basketball program's success. I think the university's spirit, and again, I go back to it. I've been using that line, like the ability to unite and inspire our community where, you know, this is not about whether we're 5-2 in the league or, you know, whether we beat South Carolina by 30 or whether we lose a close one. It's an opportunity for us to, you know, publicly, you know, we're on television every game and, you know, show people all over the country what, you know, GW is all about. What our student body is all about, and it gives, you know, people an opportunity to, you know, get interested in what we're doing here at the university. That's obviously a great school, top 60 school in the country, tremendous location, you know, law school, medical school, all those things, great business school as well. So, you know, in a cool way, I think everybody sort of understands that, you know, their role as a part of what we're doing at the overall university level.
So GW as a university and specifically in the athletic department has a very interesting opportunity come that's going to happen this summer. The Colonials nickname is going to be retired and they need to go out and pick a new team name. So as someone who's spent a lot of time in the area and now is probably one of the most influential voices in the university, do you have a cool nickname in mind
for
a team that you'd like to coach?
I really don't. No one. I mean, we've been asked to give some thoughts. There's a committee. I'm not on the committee. I mean, I heard there's many committees of which, you know, I'm sure people that have been around GW longer than I have will have a better sense of what is appropriate. I'm not like the most creative guy in the world either. So I'm sure I've been told it's not going to be the Hippos. So that might be a bummer for some people. Certainly I like it. I like, we like the George's head on things, right? Like any opportunity to display the father of our country, George Washington, is I'm good with that. You know, I joked at a meeting the other day, I said, hey, if not for George Washington, we'd all be drinking tea instead of coffee here now. So I'm happy for that. I'm a big fan of coffee. So Yeah, I think it'll be an exciting opportunity. You know, hopefully, you know, it lines up. I'm pretty sure it will. We can rally around it, get a bunch of new gear and sort of brand it differently. But I think ultimately, like, you know, we are synonymous with you know, George Washington, Washington, D.C., the Washington Monument. And so all those things, I think, won't go away, you know, for us.
So we'll close it out here. You got plenty of season left to go, and yeah, I'm sure a lot of fun wins in your future. Oh. But you're 20 games into mm-hmm. your career right now. Do you have a moment or a memory that just already stands out to you as something that you'll remember from this season?
Yeah, it's kind of personal. It's funny, like we beat Dayton, and you know, we always sing the fight song at half court, and then I asked the guys, win or lose, you know, go thank the students that are in the student section. It's important, again, for them to engage, and as part of the student experience, I want all the students to engage, and so that's really fun. And then last week when we beat Dayton, I looked over, and my daughter, and then Coach Dwayne Lee's daughter, they're all about the same age, about 8 years old. They were like, and my 3-year-old as well, sort of with some chaperoning, they were in the student section cheering, you know? So, really, I think fun for coaches, kids to take part in that experience, even though they're not in college yet. And, the good news is, you know, they get to do that without us paying the GW tuition, you know, and kind of do that for free.
Well, it's an exciting time, and it's especially been an exciting last few weeks at George Washington for the coaches, the students, and the families. So, Coach Chris Caputo, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
All right. We're going to dive into the Wednesday games because, Matt, I don't know if you disagree here, but that was probably the most exciting day. Well, I guess depending on your fandom, it was certainly the most interesting day of the conference season to this point.
It was a good one. We had 6 games all at once, so it was an awful lot to keep track of around the A-10. But yeah, we had some really close games, exciting finishes around the league.
So the best game was GW St. Joe's, but we just talked to Coach Caputo, so we'll hold that for a few minutes. We might as well just go right in on Dayton's loss to Rhode Island. And for me, watching from afar, the biggest thing, it's really concerning that now that Dayton's guards are back, all of a sudden they haven't been able to stop dribble penetration 2 games in a row.
It was just terrible for Dayton, and the Flyers got off to a great start. The first 10 minutes of the game, I think they were playing as up-tempo as they have all year, and it was working. They were getting out in transition. The offense was smooth. And then all of a sudden, Rhode Island just got back into the game. And yeah, I mean, Ish Leggett in particular was just getting by defenders at will. And once he made a couple baskets and Rhodey's other guys got involved making a couple threes, just the wheels came off for Dayton quickly.
Yeah, and no RJ Blakeney in this game. He's a wonderful defender, and he probably would have been the man tasked with Ish Leggett for most of the game. But this team is too good for the excuse to be, oh, no RJ Blakeney.
Well, and this is my whole point with Dayton. Like, and as frustrating as the season has quickly become over the last week, like, we're going to get every game the rest of the year on national TV, and you're going to hear 2 things. You're going to hear about the OB year. We get that. We're used to it. But you're going to hear about all Dayton's injuries they've had to deal with this year. Well, guess what? They got their 2 starting guards back, and they lost both. I've had enough. You can't use that as an excuse for the Flyers anymore. And even missing RJ Blakeney in that Rhode Island game, it would have been great to have him on the court, but does that even make the difference? I'm not sure. The Flyers were well behind for most of the second half. The final score ended up being kind of close, losing by 5, but they shouldn't be giving up 75 points, even missing him.
Yeah, I believe that they are 1-3 with their full complement of players available. Losses to Wisconsin, NC State, and GW, with the only win coming at home against a not awful, but still definitely below average Robert Morris team.
So I just think with that, we can, like, the injuries are a fair point. If you want to bring that up as a reason for why Dayton didn't hit their full ceiling this year, that's fine. But I think we can just agree it right now. If everyone was healthy the whole year, this still wouldn't have been a top 25 team. There's a lot of other problems going on with this team.
Yeah, it's really weird because they're getting hurt in areas where getting Smith and Elvis back should help them. Like, mm-hmm. having those guys should actually help you to better guard Breon Freeman, who's a smaller, quicker guard. I feel like Kobe Elvis, probably not 100% healthy yet, but he's the guy who should be tasked with that assignment most of the time. And we'll keep harping on the defense because that was what it came down to. In the end, they still got the 70 points. The offense was pretty clunky at times, and for about 4 minutes, it felt like Elvis was basically saving them on that end, but they did what they had to do on offense, and it really hasn't looked pretty all year. If they get to 70 against a bottom six team in the A-10, they should expect to win that game running away.
I would agree. And I think, too, the important thing to bring up, both Elvis and Smith have been playing really well offensively since they've come back from their injuries. Malachi's had three good games in a row. Like you said, Kobe Elvis was the best player in the second half for Dayton. But they just haven't gotten the whole team playing well at the same time. And this was definitely, I think, the weakest performance we've seen in a while from Dayton's post.
Yeah, and this isn't all just a negative Dayton thing. Rhode Island was overdue in conference play for a game where both of their stars played great at the same time. And it finally came. They didn't get a ton offensively from anyone outside of their scoring big three of those two and Jalen Carey, but Leggett managed to get himself to the foul line 11 times. Rhode Island shot 26 free throws overall, and he dominated the first half, and then Freeman took the baton in the second half and was just raining threes at a rate we haven't seen from him all year. This is the Breon Freeman that I said would be in A-10 Player of the Year consideration for next season. We hadn't seen that guy all year. Like, he came alive. The jersey was untucked. He was shooting insane fadeaways and just making everything.
I agree, and I think Rhodey did everything they needed to do to win, especially the free throw line. 23 for 26 is ridiculous, but I almost feel like, too, in some of these games, he's not quite as consistent, but I don't even know if we can call Rhodey's big two just that. I think Jalen Carey's right up there too as one of their most important players, and he had a big game against Dayton. So overall, when it comes together, this gives me the hope, like what I've been finally waiting for in a Rhode Island game, and I just wish it didn't happen against my team. But they were playing really hard, the crowd was into it, and this was definitely their biggest win of the season.
Yeah, they are climbing quick, and you know what? Everyone who is currently sitting in the pillow fight played well over these last 2 days, and we're moving on to another one of those teams that right now is threatening hard to get out of that bottom six, and that's St. Joe's, who took a three-game win streak down to D.C., lost in overtime. It feels like everyone on the Hawks are starting to click at the same time. And the big star in this one was Lynn Greer, who had a career-high 31 points. He was well into career-high territory long before the game went to overtime. Kicked in 11 rebounds. It oddly actually only had three assists, which is pretty low by his standards. But St. Joe's lost this game, but it almost feels like a moral victory that they nearly won against a better team on the road. And they're just playing such a better brand of basketball than 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely, I think, would have all agreed going into conference play that St. Joe's was going to be a lock for the pillow fight. But right now, even after that
game, 2 weeks in, they were a lock to finish way closer to the basement than getting out of it.
Yeah, but I mean, these last four games are about as good of a stretch. Maybe we could even say the last four and a half, because they were good in the second half against Duquesne. So I'll be really interested to see. They go at George Mason this weekend, which, I mean, that's an opportunity. It's on the road, but against a kind of struggling Patriots team. So we'll see if they can keep it going. But yeah, Layden Greer has really picked it up in conference play. I wasn't sure how he was going to fit in the non-conference. It seemed like he was trying to do too much scoring, but it worked out this game where he had 31, and I think he's found the right balance of setting up the shooters around him while also being able to get his own points.
Now, on the GW end, they had control of this game late in regulation, and we have to mention how this ended for anyone who didn't see. So closing seconds of regulation, they're up two, they inbound under their basket. I don't remember who the inbounder was, but he threw the ball to James Bishop in the corner. We all know that's a no-no. Bishop gets stripped, St. Joe's gets it back, ties the game, sends it to overtime. Overtime starts off with literally neither team being able to get a stop, and the first 3 minutes of it were probably the most entertaining basketball this conference has given us all year, because you had Greer and Reynolds, because Cam Brown fouled out really early in overtime. It was just Greer and Reynolds, and then Adams and Bishop on the other side just going to the rim at will, and no one could stop them. But eventually, GW ends up getting a stop up one in the final minute. Hunter Dean had gotten called for a goaltend. It was extremely close. They ended up reversing the call. And then GW turns the ball over on the inbounds again. But this time around, they come through, get the stop. They dominated most of this game, and mistakes almost killed them in the end, but it was a big, big, big night. We talked to Coach Caputo about it. Brendan Adams, 32, a career high for him as well.
And I think there's something to be said, even though this game got kind of ugly at the end for George Washington, it really feels like they're learning how to close out these tough games. Like, you go back a couple weeks ago, kind of the beginning of this hot streak against UMass, where they were way ahead, up 15, 20 points most of the second half. The Minutemen charged back, but GW never panicked. Same thing kind of happened against Dayton last weekend, where all of a sudden the Flyers made a bunch of threes in the last couple minutes, but it didn't matter because GW made enough winning plays, made enough free throws. And even this one against St. Joe's, I know they didn't want it to go to overtime, but they did just enough to win. And these are the close games. I mean, if GW wants to realistically contend for a double bye spot, which they're in position for right now, these are exactly the games they're going to have to win.
Yeah, and this game was another great example of the type of player that James Bishop has turned into. He shot the ball really poorly from the field. 5 of 19 overall, 1 of 6 from 3. I was trying to pull up the halftime stat splits, but I believe he had less than 5 points at the end of the first half. Finds his way to 22 because in the second half, he just kept getting to the line. And that's kind of his little secret weapon now. When the shots aren't falling, he'll just go throw himself into the muck, and it worked again today, or yesterday, whenever. 11 for 14 at the line for him. Really kicked it in the second half after Adams was the dominant force in the first half.
Yeah, and that feels like the game, too, where if that happened last year and James Bishop took that many shots and wasn't his normal efficient self that he is this year, that seems like a game GW would have lost. But that's not happening this year, both because he's doing enough else to make his other teammates better. I mean, he had 6 assists in that game. But also, it just helps so much that he's got Adams scoring 32, Maximus Edwards and Lindo both getting into double figures. So he's just got a lot of support around him, too.
Yep, we will keep it moving. A few quick thoughts on some other games, because we had 6 at one time. It's not possible for us to really lock in on all of these at once. VCU crushed George Mason. I watched the very beginning of that when Josh Aduro was just running loose. 17 points in the first half. and yet Mason was still down double digits at halftime. Second half, VCU adjusted, shut them down, and they were basically up like 15-16 the whole time. Mason never really threatened them at all.
Also, no Ronnie Polite in that game.
Yeah,
which is
that,
something
I really hurt George Mason, which is something we didn't expect to say in October.
Yeah, he's been really good, though. I mean, I think him and Brendan Adams, who we've been talking about a ton in this episode, like, those are your two candidates for most improved player. And seemed like, I mean, Devin Dinkins put up some decent stats in his place, but I'm pretty concerned about the long-term outlook for George Mason if it turns out he has a serious injury. So we'll see.
Especially if Gaines doesn't come back anytime soon, because that depth that was starting to look really good is now starting to thin itself out. Last thing with this was basically just a vintage VCU game. The defense is just back at another level over these last few, held George Mason to 52. No one really shined on the offensive end, but everyone just did enough to make it work. Three double-digit scores, none higher than 13. Ace had 7 assists, 9 rebounds, but shot 3 of 13 from the field. That feels like vintage Mike Rhodes VCU.
Yeah, pretty much. And we have Shriver. Again, we can't stop talking about him. 3 for 5 on three-pointers, so he's keeping it rolling.
The two games that I barely was able to get myself over to. UMass, without Fernandes and TJ Weeks, with things really just going to a weird place after all the tension on the weekend, they beat Richmond at home, scoring 53 points in the second half. I truly did not believe that UMass could score 50 points and a half without Noah Fernandes. I wasn't sure they could score 43 to 45 without him. And then Fordham goes on the road. They put up 51 in the second half. End St. Bonaventure's undefeated conference play season. And I just want to shout out a pair of freshmen from these two games. RJ Lewis for UMass, starting in place of Weeks, had 23 points, 7 rebounds, 5 assists for his first triple nickel of the year. And
second
actually,
triple nickel.
Oh,
he's leading freshman this year.
And actually, another guy on UMass, Rashul Diggins, who has struggled in the starting point guard role in place of Fernandes. He shot 4 for 5 from 3, kicked in 6 assists. It was definitely his best performance of the year, and UMass really needed it that time. And then over in Olean, man, Will Richardson, ever since he took a spot in the starting lineup for Fordham, is playing some fantastic basketball. 16 points in this one. He was a big difference maker with his energy in the first half against Duquesne when the rest of the Rams team was basically on dead legs. He's had his 3 highest scoring games of the year in their last 4. He's starting to play his way into all rookie consideration, and Fordham's just played a lot better since the lineup changes, putting him and Nowitzki in the starting lineup. Abdu Simbila's minutes have gone down a lot, and Kyle Rose is still playing a ton, but has shifted into more of just a defender six-man role.
I honestly think that might have been the most shocking result of the conference season so far. St. Bonaventure has been completely a different team at home compared to the road, and for Fordham to score 79 points is really impressive. That's 3 road wins in a row for the Rams, too. And all of a sudden, they were looking very weak the first couple weeks of conference play. Yeah, I mean, really, they've all of a sudden, they're a double bye threat at this rate. So, yeah, impressive stuff for the Rams.
Yeah, and they've actually they swept the 3 Pennsylvania teams to get their first 3 wins, and then went to Bonaventure. It hasn't been the hardest schedule in the world for the Rams, but winning at Duquesne, at the Bonnies back-to-back is really big. Now they get 2 really tough home games, having to play GW and SLU back-to-back. And with the way the home teams are playing, it's weird to say that a split is good, but I'd say a split's probably good for Fordham. keeps him safe in the top half, keeps him right around the double bye debate.
I know it's like it's too early to get wrapped up in the standings, but did you think we would have a Fordham George Washington game with a lot on the line for the double bye race? Because whoever wins is going to be in, I mean, more for GW than Fordham, but it's going to help out a lot whoever takes that one over the weekend.
I mean, I at least would have thought that it would have had a ton of meaning for the single bye race, but
exactly.
Yeah.
But it's that's crazy stuff.
Bonaventure, it's the same problem that we've talked about a few times this year. Daryl Banks goes off for 29. No one else scores more than 10. And they just struggle to cobble together offense outside of him. So which Pennsylvania game should we go to now? We got two left. And by the way, all seven games were really notable. That's why we're doing this right now. We typically don't go game for game, but they were all super interesting this week.
We can go back to Tuesday if you want to talk about the one standalone game, which we actually got to. This is the one that we tuned into the most, probably, because it was the one game on Tuesday night. Davidson taking down LaSalle at Tom Gola Arena. And I think the key to this one that we wanted to hit on, some interesting lineups thrown out there by Fran Dunphy. Maybe some players we weren't expecting to see a whole lot of, but Andres Marrero and Jorge Sanchez Ramos got a lot of minutes, both starting, and we didn't see as many of the notable guards that LaSalle's had most of these games.
Yeah, their top four scorers, Brantley, Brickus, Gill, and Nickelberry, which I don't remember Anwar Gill even getting in the game, but apparently he played 10 minutes. Those four combined for 34 minutes because Brantley ended up getting 15. He played a big chunk of the second half when they were trying to close out the game. It's clear that it was some sort of unofficial suspension message, and Dunphy had some comments after the game about they were super, super vague as to what had happened, but basically these guys did something wrong either in the effort or the mindset department. For LaSalle's sake, I really hope Dunphy got through to them, because even if he takes out two of them or plays them just a little bit more, they win this game. Like, Davidson just did not play well at all besides Menenga, who was killing LaSalle's bigs, who ironically were the starters that actually played. But LaSalle's backup guards played about as well as Davidson's backcourt played in this one.
Yeah, just overall an interesting game, and turning it on, like watching the starting lineups get announced, it's like, huh, what's going on? And then eventually when those guys all did get into the game, it's like, okay, so they're still available. Nobody's hurt. But I think you're right. The big story to me was Menenga going off for 27 points. And that was one of his best games of the year. Really impressive against LaSalle, who was playing a big lineup. But then overall, I do for the Explorers, we've shouted him out a couple times recently, but Deshaun Shepherd over the last month or so has been playing some great basketball, and he led the team with 14 points, had 5 more rebounds, and he's quickly becoming one of my favorite role players in the conference. Just one of the most athletic rebounders in the league, great at driving to the basket. He's had some audacious dunk attempts over the last couple games, and just really enjoyable to watch. I'm glad that he's gotten more of an opportunity.
It's funny because I actually came away from that game more blown away by Andres Marrero, who got the start. He kicked in 10 points, but those two both showed us a lot. Those are two guys that I hope really stick around with LaSalle, and they probably need to play more. Now, if Dunphy would like to remove any one of these four guys from the rotation in future games, he's got some good replacements there. All I ask to Fran Dunphy, please don't make us watch both Dramés and Mamadou Doucouré all on the court together at the same time. It's too slow. They made Davidson look really fast in this game, and that has never happened to a McKillop coach team in history.
First time ever, I think. That was interesting to watch.
All right. we saved the weirdest for last on the other side of Pennsylvania. And you know what? If you still care about the Uber Eats thing 2 days later, then we'll let you keep waiting for two more minutes. Hit the game part first. Duquesne comes back against Loyola in a game where they were down big early in the first half. I believe the lead got as high as 14 at one point. Philip Alston was absolutely sensational. 5 of 10 from three, 25 points. Duquesne was just kind of leaving them open. I think a little bit of it was schemed. A few of them were mistakes, but he killed them when they did. Other than that, the Duke's defense just shut down everybody. And they made an interesting move early on, throwing Day-Day Grant on Braden Norris, despite the fact that he's basically considered to be the weakest of their three defenders. But he completely took Norris out of the flow. Loyola couldn't get any ball movement going. And the Dukes kicked into gear offensively in the second half to just kind of take over the game. It was one of those both teams were playing poorly at, for big stretches of it, but Duquesne kicked it into gear when they had to. And for me, the one play that kind of defined the game, we're inching towards the under 12 timeout in the second half. Duquesne has just taken the lead. A shot goes up. Austin Rotrov, going for an offensive rebound, catches it at the same exact time as Tom Welch. Another Loyola player comes over, gets his hands on it as well. And Rotrov just takes it. And that kind of epitomized the second half for the Dukes. They were just more powerful than Loyola. And Rotrov didn't put up much that would impress you in the box score, but I felt like he was the MVP of this game.
All right, so you were in attendance for this game. What was your take in person on the little interruption we had during play?
So I'm on the other side, court level. I didn't notice anything until I saw a guy in a bright jacket basically being escorted by an usher through the area that's normally occupied by the cheerleaders. And kind of looking around, eventually we see he's got a bag in his hand. Oddly, he's not getting thrown out. Like, he's being sent back up in the stands. There was enough there for me to believe that it was just some sort of mistake early on. Now, granted, I didn't see him on the court at the beginning. I thought he just walked in and was walking along the edge. And I think the most surprising part of it to me is how big it got. Now, this was an incredibly loaded slate, like we just talked about. Not only these games, but Pitt's playing Wake Forest to the buzzer. UConn and Xavier are in a great game. And any commercial time for us was being spent watching other games. There was no Twitter checks. I dipped over for about 20 seconds, saw Kevin Sweeney tweet the video. Figured he only did so because he's a Chicago guy and was probably watching the game live. I didn't think this was actually going to go viral because the guys in the media room after this game, first of all, everyone had already figured out it was a hoax, but nobody really cared anymore. Somehow this went on Good Morning America.
It's definitely the biggest thing that's happened to the A-10 this year, maybe in a couple years. That I can recall, but
the biggest missed opportunity here. Anyone in that media room could have had their 20 minutes of fame today. That Loyola broadcaster sent out the thread explaining why it was a hoax. Zach Weiss was screaming about that same stuff like 2 hours before those tweets came out. He could have been the one quoted in all the ESPN articles.
I just think my takeaway from this, and I'm like, my view is biased because almost every college game I've been to is at UD Arena, which is a huge place. But I feel like at a place like Duquesne and a lot of other mid-major gyms, like probably half the gyms in the A-10, it's kind of just be so easy to walk right on the court. Like, well, nobody, there's not much security. And I'm not trying to give anyone ideas. But I hope this isn't the type of thing that just takes off and keeps on happening.
Let's get into conspiracy land here.
All right, but what do you got?
So, at this point, we're recording on Thursday night. It's already been made very clear that this was some sort of prank for TikTok. But the question is, how did this come about? Was this just some inebriated college kids with a bad idea at 1 o'clock in the morning? That's way too easy of an answer. This was orchestrated all the way from the top, from the office of Atlantic 10 Commissioner Bernadette McGlade. And hear me out on this one. It's been a rough year for the A-10. Like you said, this is the biggest thing to happen all year. They could use some attention. They could use people talking about something that happened at one of their schools. And as awesome as this A-10 slate was, no one on the national scene cared about it last night. Tristan Freeman mentioned over and over again last night how incredible the 7 o'clock slate was. You had a UConn-Xavier game go down to the wire. You had multiple huge bubble clashes. Like, what was happening in the A-10 was a complete afterthought to basically anyone besides us and the people who are listening to us right now. So they took their opportunity to get themselves on screen. Why do it at Duquesne? It's the best choice of any of the A-10 arenas here. You can't do it at a place like UD Arena. First of all, you can't even sell the idea that that person's getting through the door. UD Arena's got security out the wazoo every second that there's someone in that building. There's no chance in holy hell that an Uber Eats driver's ever walking into there. And even if they somehow did, they have to walk through half the seats to get to the court. If that happens there, anyone in this attendance knows it's a hoax. Even St. Bonaventure, where you might be able to get in the door because it's attached to the student union by a hallway, but it's the same thing. You're on the middle level. You got to walk all the way through the stands to get to the court. It's just not logical. Duquesne, you have an accessible arena that's also going to look very nice on the TV shot. Like, if this happens at Gola, we're not even talking about the prank anymore. We're just talking about how it's such a LaSalle thing that happened.
If it happened at the Gola, the cameraman would have missed it, too. No one would have known.
We would have found out on the next Gola Standard episode because Richie and Dennis were 2 of 100 people that witnessed it go down. But Duquesne, for anyone unfamiliar, the coop is built into a hill. And so the main entrance is on court level. You come in and then you have to turn to the side and go up a pretty sizable staircase. But there's also another option to go into a hallway that's a lot closer to you that will lead you right onto the corner of the court. If there's no security presence at the door or the security guy's not paying attention, it's incredibly possible that someone could walk right through that door and walk onto the court in the middle of a game. And so it's kind of the perfect venue for it. Now, why would the A-10 pick now to do it? Why would they do this? Well, what was the biggest story off the court last week in the midweek that we actually never talked about on here but should have? Chris Mooney going at John Rothstein for continually offering ideas for how the A-10 teams could improve their scheduling. We know what else John Rothstein does frequently. He gives the A-10 ideas for how they should improve the whole conference at Iona, put the tournament at the Palestra, which I do want to talk about one of these days because I have thoughts on that one. And I'm sure at some point the people in the commissioner's office have gotten annoyed that this guy's trying to do their job for them. So what do? They take over the internet that night. They use America's favorite dumb hobby, TikTok. And in the immortal words of John Rothstein, other people have hobbies. I watch college basketball. Well, in maybe the best 7 o'clock window of the year, you know what John Rothstein's Twitter feed was probably full of? Some idiot walking onto the court in a game that he was definitely not paying attention to. He went on hoping for comments about how great the end of UConn Xavier was, about how Pitt is playing themselves into the field. And instead, he gets this full. And I guarantee you, for at least 2 minutes, he was pissed about this.
I think you're right. Maybe it was just somebody that wanted to eat like a champion today, and they were getting food delivered at the arena. Is that possible? Or we confirm that it's a hoax?
It could be. He had the proper bag. Like, it had the McDonald's sticker on it. It looked authentic. And then they cut away on the Jumbotron to him giving the bag to somebody. That is the weirdest part of all of this, and why I wanted to start thinking about conspiracies in the first place. Because if this is just some idiot student, they should have just thrown him out on the spot. He stayed, and now I think someone reported that he got thrown out eventually, but he was in there for at least 5 minutes. And at one point, it looked like he was trying to walk back on the court again, and the usher redirected him back up the stands.
So is this the most mid-major thing that's happened to the A-10? Because last night I said it was the most mid-major event since the unveiling of the LaSalle smoke machine. I mean, maybe it's not mid-major because of how much attention it got Duquesne. Like, this is definitely the best publicity they've gotten since, I don't know, didn't Bronny James like an Instagram post one time that had Keith Dambrada in it or something?
Probably.
So that's a big deal for the Dukes, I guess. That's going to go on all the recruiting PowerPoints.
It was a big deal from the true MVP of the moment, the analyst on the ESPN Plus broadcast, Ellis Cannon, who's, for anyone outside the Pittsburgh area doesn't know, him and Tim Benz, the guys who do that, are basically like the big afternoon sports talk guys on the radio. Cannon was sensational on that call that's been passed around over and over again. That was his best moment of the season. So,
yeah. Crazy stuff. And you never know in mid-major basketball, but that's part of the fun of it, isn't it?
It really is. And you know what? This was kind of nice for the Dukes because we've gone this whole time without talking about the biggest thing for them right now. They're struggling to shoot the ball at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to need to kick it into gear next week going up to UMass. But the last three games, the threes have not been falling. And that's why they lost to Fordham. The defense played them through it in this one. But it's a concerning thing for the Dukes because at halftime, it felt like they had a chance to potentially lose grip on this season. Do you lose back-to-back home games to teams you're favored over in this tight conference this year? That could very well be the difference between a double bye and the pillow fight. And they got it together and pulled this one out. They desperately needed to.
I think you're right. So the one team we haven't talked about at all, St. Louis had their little bye this week.
Yeah.
And this is going to be interesting, though, because the Billikens have a chance, I believe, to tie for the lead in the conference. Yeah. So if they win, they could be momentarily tied with VCU. But they got to go to Belk Arena, a place that has been a house of horrors for many teams, but especially the Billikens over the years. And I think the number one thing to keep an eye on, Davidson has been awful shooting the ball this year. But are they going to wake up on national television against the team that they've historically done very well against? Should be a pretty interesting Friday night showcase this week.
Well, funny enough, I think this game comes down to whether or not Sam Mananga can come somewhat close to what he did at LaSalle.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis Okoro and Jake Forrester are both playing a lot better ball right now than they were in the non-con. But Mananga's still the better big there. They're going to try to play through him early on. See if they can pummel Slew down low like Iona did and go after him that way.
Yeah, we will see. I feel like we're due for a big Foster Lawyer game. He still hasn't done.
We are desperately. It hasn't come since like November now.
No, he had 21 against Loyola. That was really his last big game. January 4th. So
yeah, we've gone from Foster Lawyers in a slump to, wow, Foster Lawyer might just not be playing like a star this year territory.
Yeah, well, I hope he gets it back together. But any final thoughts on a fun night of A10 basketball? Because overall, I think you're right. We had to spend more time on this one because it was one of both the most entertaining and the most consequential nights the league has seen this year.
Yeah, the biggest thing for me, because it just popped up about an hour ago, it's the number four story on the ESPN app right now. Duquesne is revisiting their security protocols after the incident. Earlier this year, not like a decade ago, I witnessed about 10 students just walk into the arena during halftime unencumbered. So, yeah, probably overdue for the Dukes to revisit the security protocol.
Yeah, I think that's a good reminder. I'm sure they wish it didn't come to this, but yeah, interesting to see. I just hope, though, like, this was hilarious. I hope there aren't knuckleheads trying to do this every game. It's already difficult enough. Like, you see coaches making their way onto the court, basically acting as a sixth man guarding 3-point shooters. We don't need fans walking on the court to do.
Yeah, I forget who tweeted it out. Credit to you, whoever you were. They needed the security guard that tried to choke out the cameraman after the VCU Bonnies A-10 championship game. So if anyone tries this at UD Arena, that guy is taking them out. So be warned.
That was iconic. I had forgotten about that. What a weird time that was. A neutral site, like no, hardly any fans, but the ones that were there had to protect themselves, I guess.
My true final thought here, it's not original. We've talked about it over and over already, but we're starting to get this group of six separating at the bottom. And it looked like it was lining up nicely, that we already knew who the pillow fighters were, and we just don't. Everyone's kind of just at the same level. VCU's not right now the way they're playing. St. Louis is not the way they're playing. And honestly, GW might be worthy of being in the group with those two than with the rest of the crew. Loyola's at the moment appears to be a little bit below, but there's not much separating 4 through 14 right now. Somebody, I'd put my money on either UMass or St. Joe's, but someone who's in that bottom six right now is going to be out of it in the next 10 days.
Yeah, and that means that between, like, we have 4-4-4 teams, Duquesne, Richmond, Mason, St. Bonaventure. And if that happens, that means one of those teams could be playing on Tuesday afternoon. And it could happen. It's
I think it
be
probably will
race.
Happen.
Yeah.
So that does it for this episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. Another big thanks to Coach Caputo for coming on and joining us at the outset. If anyone's still interested, go back and listen to our episode from earlier in the week where we talked about last weekend's games. Be sure to give us 5 stars on iTunes if you enjoyed the show. Please send us any comments on Twitter at the number 3BidLeaguePod. And everyone, just continue to enjoy this season. We have our first Sunday game coming up this weekend, St. Joe's and George Mason.